We have to finish up one little thing in Nehemiah because we only got up to chapter 4 last week. I want to finish one more topic in Nehemiah. If we have time, we'll get to Esther. If not, we have 3 more weeks afterwards to Purim. So it'll be fun. Because one of the topics on Begilah, we dealt with it already when we did the missing years. So it'll be, we only need two weeks for that instead of 3. But we have a lot of important things to do on Nehemiah. Nehemiah is a lot of fun now. And I'm going to summarize what happened. We got to chapter 4 last week. We're going to summarize chapter 5 and 6 quickly. And we're going to do something in Nehemiah, which will hopefully help understand everything that's going on, everything we talked about last week, and Nehemiah the politician, as opposed to Ezra the rabbi. And actually be a class about education or informal education, I hope. So I'm going to share my screen. Today we don't need any fancy source sheets. It's simply all from the book of Nehemiah. We might, you know, see a pasuk somewhere here or there, but almost everything's from Nehemiah. At the end of chapter 5, what I'm skipping in chapter 5 was Nehemiah makes a big deal about people, Jews, who were oppressing other Jews. The economic situation was really bad, and Nehemiah is confronted by the people, the poor people, who are helping him build the wall, and they tell him, no, we have to sell our children into slavery, we can't make a living, all of our property is being mortgaged, and there's a couple like big shots in town who aren't letting us make a living. And Nehemiah yells at them and makes them swear. And basically, they know all the debts. And basically, Nehemiah is able to do some, I guess, social reform and gets the people out of debt. So not only does he build the walls of the city, he builds the social fabric of the community. And that's another big thing he's able to do. But he can do it because he has political strength, and the big shots are now afraid of him. Now, that's within the Jewish community. Now, remember the arch enemies, Sanballat, from the Shomronim, and Tovia, the Ammonim, and Geshem, the Aravim. So now they say that they're successful. They all see Kibaniti at the Chomah. They see that he's built the wall, and there's no openings left. And even though the wall is built, they still have to finish the gates themselves. But basically, the things are coming along. And now they can't stop him. They weren't able to attack them because they had a little civil defense. And now they want to assassinate him. So by Ishlach Sanballat v'Geshem Elai Lemor, Lucho v'Nivada Yachta b'Kfirim b'Bikat Ono v'Im Chosvim Lasut Lira. They invite Nehemiah. Oh, you're now the governor. We'll see later on. He actually becomes the official governor of Yerushalayim. And Sanballat invites him to come to have a meeting, a private meeting, in a place called Kfirim. They're not sure where that is. Bikat Ono probably is somewhere in between the area of Jewish jurisdiction and Sanballat's jurisdiction, again, all under the Persian authorities. So let's go meet in a neutral place and we'll have a meeting. Of course, Nehemiah realizes they want to assassinate him. V'eshlacha alehem melachim lemor, melacha gdola ani oseh, I'm too busy now. Lo ochal leredet. He didn't say, I don't trust you guys. He's got to play his politics. He says, I'm too busy for a meeting now, maybe another time. Lama tishbata melacha kasher arfeha, virati alehem. I don't have time. If I leave, the whole building project is going to be ruined. And they send him over and over again, 4 times, and he gives the same answer. Now comes the fun part, and in light of this, we'll understand all the things we talked about last week about the tightrope that Nehemiah has to walk and why he makes himself such a nebuch in front of Artaxerxes, the king of Persia, saying, remember he talks about Yerushalayim, Ir Kivrot Avotai? That was our main topic last week, I think. That, you know, I want to go just build up the city. He doesn't want to make himself look like he's starting a new nation. Like I gave the example of the Jews under the British, you know, we can be part of the British Empire and a colony, but we're not going to declare independence. That would be too much. And therefore, if you do too many things and start a Jewish defense force and things like that, they're going to start worrying that maybe you're going to rebel against the Persian authority. Sanballat is aware of that as well. And now that he can't assassinate him, he's going to threaten to take Nehemiah to the authorities. So Yishlach Elai Sanballat Kedvar Zeh Pam Chamishit, that Daro, and he gave me an Iger Ptucha. He says, here's a letter I'm about to badmouth you. He says, here's the letter I'm going to send and publicize to the king. And if you don't come and meet me, I'm going to publicize this. And instead of me knocking you off, basically, I'll let the Persians do it. Okay. For Ketubo, what's in the official letter? Bogoyim Nishma. Now, Vigash Bomer is really hard to translate. Some people say Geshem, the Aravi guy, maybe, but in I think in the Targum HaShivim, it's not even there, that phrase. The main thing is, here's the open letter. Let it be known to the nations. Okay, the what? Ata b'Yudim choshvim limrod. You, Nehemiah, and your Jewish comrades, you're planning to rebel against the Persians. Al kein ata boneh chomah. That's why you're building the wall of the city. It's not for to make the look to make the city look nice. It's not like a monumental city, the Erki Brot Avotai. You're not making Jerusalem look nice, being part of the Persian Empire. You're building the walls of the city because you're planning to rebel. Okay? Vatahuvelhem, you want to make yourself king. You went from butler, remember, to governor, now to king. Okay. Kedvarim and things like that. And now on top of that, and this is the most interesting part. You've appointed prophets. Remember Haggai talking about hinting to the future of Jewish sovereignty? Not only return to sovereignty, I mean, not only return to prosperity, but also the return to hinting, at least alluding to the return to sovereignty on his famous Nevuah when they were breaking ground on the temple back in Haggai chapter 2. He says, you have your prophets. In other words, the drushes on Shabbos morning in Shul, when no one's recording it, they're talking about the return of Jewish sovereignty to Israel. Okay. And this movement you're doing is not just to make Yerushalayim look nice. You guys are planning to declare independence. And it's not fabricated and nothing, because as we know, all through Jewish history, there's always people who are on the right-wing side knowing that there's a Jewish value in being sovereign in our land. Through the whole First Temple period, we were sovereign. And we're supposed to be sovereign in our land. And this brings back to what happened in the time of the end of the First Temple period, when Yirmiyahu's prophecy that God was punishing them, that because you haven't been following my rules, I'm bringing the Babylonians to take over your country. And Yirmiyahu told the people, if you accept Babylonian sovereignty and renege your own sovereignty, the temple doesn't have to be destroyed and you don't have to go into exile. That's their whole punishment. No one believed him. And all the false prophets who thought they were real prophets were saying, no, there's no way that God would ever tell us to be subservient to a foreign power. And because there's so many sources in earlier Nevi'im talking about this messianic idea that we're going to have a king again and we'll be sovereign again in our land, there's a lot of basis for this Lashon Hara about Nehemiah. Now, Nehemiah might be praying for this. And if you look at Shmone Esrei, you can definitely see roots of saying the Jews want to rebel and make their own kingdom. And to top it off, if you remember Babylonian history, only about like some, it wasn't in their lifetime, but it was 100 years back, but it was written. When the Babylonians first took over the city, the first time Nebuchadnezzar came and exiled Jehoiachin and made Zedekiah king, he was a vassal king. What did the Jews do? The Jews went against that treaty and rebelled against the Babylonians and tried to make and rebelled and started their own kingdom again against the treaty they made. And here they're starting up again. We didn't have time to read it, but chapters 4, 5, and 6 in Ezra had a similar exchange of letters by the Tzarei Yehuda Binyamin much earlier, gave a very similar complaint. In fact, some scholars say it's the same. Those letters going back and forth is what we're talking about over here. Now, therefore, what he's saying basically is that he's accusing this guy, Sanballat, our enemy, who's vying for power under the Persian rule. He's claiming Nehemiah is planning a revolt against the Persians. And that's why he's building the wall. And that's why he's not coming to the meeting. And there's rumors going around that they're starting a kingdom and Nehemiah is going to become the king. And it's Reshit Smichat Gulatenu, which is our big topic. And now the king's going to hear about these things. Since the king's going to hear, let's go and meet, and maybe I can help solve you the problem. In other words, he's enticing Nehemiah to come. If you come to this meeting, maybe I can help you with this. But he's trying to get Nehemiah so he can assassinate him. Okay. Says that's fake news. Not true. You're making that up. You have no source for that. I mean, you do have a source for that, but that's not what we're planning. And therefore, I don't believe it. Okay. Now, on top of that, they're trying all these different tricks to get Nehemiah to get assessed, to get in trouble. They're doing all this politics. Everyone's trying to scare Nehemiah so that the work won't be done. Now, there's this guy, Shmuel. I'll just summarize the story. And what's he tell Nehemiah to do? He's planted by Sambala. He tells, "Yomer Niva'ein al Beit Elohim al Toch Eichal." He tells Nehemiah, "Let's have a meeting, a safe meeting. You're worried? Let's meet inside the Beit HaMikdash, inside the Eichal. When he's grabbed al Toch Eichal, we close the doors of the Eichal, we can meet there. It's safe. Kibayim Largecha. Hey, they're coming to kill you. Let's hide inside. But Laila Bayim Largecha." He tells Nehemiah, "Come with me. I'll protect you. Let's go hide in the Beit HaMikdash to save you from assassination," because they realize that Nehemiah is afraid of assassination. And now they're tricking him by sending a fellow Jew, this guy named Shmaya. You'll see Sambalat has a lot of connections with the Jewish people. We saw that background from before. And what they want to do that so that later they'll accuse Nehemiah of desecrating the temple by hiding in the temple. Okay? And what's Nehemiah answer back? Well, Mra ha'ish kamoni yivrach. I'm going to run away. I'm going to hide. I have to hide in the temple. Who is someone like me? I'm not a kohen. I can't go into the Eichal. I can't go into God's temple and stay alive. Lo, I'm not coming to meet you there. Okay? But Akira, and he realized what's Nehemiah say. That wasn't a messenger from God. That wasn't someone. That was a trick. The Tovia Sambalat Scharo. Tovia and Sambalat are arch enemies. They hired him to trick me to go to the temple to make me look bad. Okay? Okay? And because in order that I would go and I would sin, and then I would have a bad name, they're looking for all these ways to get Nehemiah in trouble, and Nehemiah is smart enough not to fall for the traps. Then he asks God to remember what Tovi and Sambalat have done, and also Noyada HaNaviyah. It's interesting. There's a female Navi who's a false Navi also trying to trick Nehemiah. Okay? And all the other Navim who are trying to scare me. And he's asking God, remember, to give them what they do. Okay. So I simply wanted to show you the tension and how entrenched Sambalat and Tuvia Hamoni, our arch enemies, how many connections they have with the Jewish people, which Nehemiah is trying to fight. And that all is reflected still with all the foreign wives they have as well, as we'll see in the next couple of psukim. Now, what's important for us is the wall's finished on the 25th day of Elul. After 52 days, remember, they came and he arrived, and now the wall's done in a very short amount of time. Okay. And then he summarizes when everyone heard, when our enemies heard. They were scared because, hey, we finished the job. And this was a sign to them, hey, God's on our side. Now, then he just sort of summarizes here, and during that time, Marbim Chorei Yudavi Groteim Hochot Al Tovia, Bashar Tovia Botavem. There's an exchange of letters between Tovia, Nehemiah's arch enemy, and leaders of Judah who have connections with him. They're telling him stories, they're giving him back. And basically, Nehemiah is pretty much caught in a trap where his own people are working for the enemy and trying to bring him down. Why? Kibrabim biyuda balei shvualo. A lot of people have connections already with Tovia, and there's all this internal politics and talks about different marriage relationships he has with them as well. Now we get to our fun part. They talk about finishing the walls, they finished up the gates of the city. And then we get a list of the people who made Aliyah, which we're going to skip for now. We'll go to this when we get to who is Achashverosh. We'll return to this list because here Mordechai is mentioned. Is this Mordechai? Our Mordechai or not? That if we have time, we'll return to it this week. We'll get to it for sure next week. Now, here's what's important for us today. We finished the wall at the end, remember, of the 6th month, a couple of days before Rosh Hashanah, and now it's time for Rosh Hashanah. In other words, the building project of the wall is finally finished. The walls are done. The doors are done. The city's secure, and it's time to have a celebration. But remember, there was this joint effort, and we talked about that last week, how everyone was involved in building the wall around the city. And now it's time for Yom Tov. And we're going to see now how Ezra now, together with Nehemiah, are going to take this nationalistic pride and this physical rebuilding of Yerushalayim to begin our spiritual rebuilding of Yerushalayim. Now, chapter 8 is extremely famous, and we're going to spend some time on it. Number one, there's many halachot that we have today. Remember last week we saw the halacha of Seisa Kochavim and Olchot HaShachar for davening based on the pasuk. But here we have halachot which are explicit here, which we keep to this day. So again, what's the date? We just finished the physical rebuilding of the walls of Yerushalayim. Remember, the temple has been built, but we've fixed the walls of the city itself. And now we're ready for a gathering. The whole nation gathers together, unified. Rechov doesn't mean a street. In ancient Hebrew, it means a plaza, like rachav, like wide. In the open plaza outside the Watergate, and if anyone wants a source for Watergate, people grew up in time of Nixon and stuff. So Watergate is an old topic. But it's a big place where they gathered, but there was no secrets here. Now is the first time we find Nehemiah and Ezra working together. Now, the fact that Ezra has not been on the scene since year 7 of Artaxasta, and this is at least year 20, some people even hold maybe it took more than a year to finish up the wall when everything was finished. But assuming year 20 or 21 of Artaxasta, it's been 13, 14 years since Ezra first made Aliyah. And we're going to see, even though Ezra came to teach the people Torah, they remain extremely ignorant. And Ezra did not have a Torah in Motion program set up. So he didn't have the people. Maybe he solved the intermarriage a little bit. And remember, we assumed there must have been something disastrous happening between Ezra's Aliyah and Nehemiah's Aliyah, because Hananiah, who came to Persia and told Nehemiah of the news, the dilapidated state of the city, didn't sound like he's talking about something happened 100 years back, but rather something happened more recently. So we see from here that Ezra is still around, but he definitely did not achieve his goal up until now, because he can only achieve his goal after Nehemiah achieves his goal. Now, what I want to point out here, in order for the rabbi Ezra, who's very learned, to be successful, he needs someone like Nehemiah. In other words, you need a masi person, and you need a rabbi teaching, but you need the community leader who knows how to lead and to build. If I want to take, I'll follow this analogy all through the rest of the class today. Remember the old days when we used to have summer camp for children in the summer and things like that? We used to have shuls and things like that. So in camp, there's two types of staff. There's what's called Tzevet Chinuch and Tzevet Hadracha, meaning there's instructional teachers who teach Torah, who teach swimming, who teach, maybe rope, teach arts and crafts. You have educational staff and you have Hadracha, which I guess you call in English Hadracha, counselors, I guess. But they're in the bunk they're in the bunk. They take the kids on hikes. They pick the teams. They have a Shira. If you follow this in Chumash, actually, because Parsha Yitro is coming up, I'll give you an example. There's two stories where Moshe Rabbeinu goes to middle management, meaning Moshe is doing too much himself, and he has to sort of delegate to share his trouble. One story is in Parsha Yitro. The other story is in Parsha Balotcha. And some people want to say they're similar or the same, but I think they're very different. In Parsha Yitro, Yitro sees that Moshe is teaching Torah all day long, answering questions, and he can't do it alone. He needs help, doesn't he? So you can't do this all alone. But that's Moshe, the educator, teaching Chukei Olam V'Torah Tav. That's educational staff. And God tells Moshe, you need educational staff to help. Yitro tells Moshe, you need some helpers. You need what we call Rami Min Yeshiva. You can't be a Rosh Yeshiva yourself. You need teachers as well. And people helping you answer the people's questions. A rough question comes to the Rosh Yeshiva, but you need Ramim, you need the regular Rabbim to deal with all the people's questions. In Parsha Balotcha, when the people are complaining about the food, they're complaining about the travels and the trouble. When Moshe throws it and says, I can't take it anymore, remember he tells God, if that's my job, I'd rather die. Just kill me now. Don't make me leave this people. When they complain about the food and the manna, they don't like the food anymore. And Moshe can't take all the complaining. And God tells Moshe, gather 70 elders that you know are already accepted leaders. That's Tzevet Hadracha. That's helping him, what's called Masam, to lead the people in their, not just in their travel, but also in their day-to-day life. That's a different type of leadership. And Moshe was taking both jobs. He was both the counselor leader and was also the educational leader. And he needed help in both realms. So I'm pointing that out because the teaching side, the Tzevet Chinuch, is Ezra, but the Tzevet Hadracha, the people organizing the people, political organization, making the whole project, setting up projects like building up the wall and things like that, and playing the politics, that's Nehemiah. Now that the Nehemiah got the people involved, now it's time to teach Torah. What am I doing with this? If you're going to teach Torah to people, you have to put them in the right mood. And now we're going to read the story, and we'll see how this will explain what's going to happen next, because there's going to be a lot of big questions coming up. Pasuk Bet. Ve'avi Ezra Kohen et ha-Torah lifnei ha-Kahal me'ish v'adisha kol mevin lishmoa b'yom achad l'chodesh ha-Shvi. It's Yom Tov anyhow. That's just Rosh Chodesh Tishrei. It's also Rosh Hashanah. Everyone's gathering anyhow, by outside the house of God. Ezra says, what a great time to teach Torah. And it seems like maybe it's not the first time, but a major time that Ezra has an audience to teach Torah. And notice who's coming to learn Torah. This is good for Torah motion. Mi'ish v'adisha, even women. Not even women. Of course, women come to learn as well. And anyone able to understand, okay, on the first day of the month. Vayikra bo lifnei rochov asher lifnei shar hamayim mina or bad machsit hayom, from early in the day until midday, neged ha'anashim v'hanashim v'amevinim, in front of the men and the women. The mevinim, I'm going to explain to you soon, are the teachers. They help, we'll prove it in a minute. In other words, Moshe has to give the class to all the people and their teachers. He gives a shir kali, and then the mevinim are going to go around and teach it to the people, because they didn't understand Moshe Rabbeinu. They have to explain it in detail. I mean, they didn't understand Ezra. Okay? Kol ha'am el sefer ha-Torah. All the people are listening to the laws of the Torah. Pasuk Dalet. Vayamod Ezra sofer migdal etz asher asu ledavar. This is called a bima nowadays. If you've ever been to Tzfat, I'm sure some must have been to Tzfat, every old shul in Tzfat has a bima. What's a bima in English? I don't know. There's no word for it. Everyone knows what a bima is. A bima is a high, what's it called?
Platform.
A platform, okay.
Or a pulpit.
But he built a tower made out of wood, high up, to read the Torah from. Every shul in Tzfat, almost every shul, every ancient shul, from the 1500s and 1800s, the chazan davens from the front, but in the middle of the shul is a bima. It's either got 7 or 13 steps going up, depending on which Kabbalist built it. And the Torah reading is way high up, way above the people, in the middle of the shul. And that minhag comes from the time of Ezra. To read the Torah from high up and the people down below. We daven from low down, but we read the Torah from high up. Does it have to be out of wood, or because wood was the thing that was around then? Yeah, I don't think it has to be dafka wood, but in Tzfat, they're all made out of wood. Okay. Vayamod etzlo. We won't read all the names, but there's 6 men to his right and 6 men to his left. Now, if you count really, it's 7. There's an argument whether it's 6 or 7. There's definitely 6 on the right and the left, either 6 or 7, depending whether it's Chari Meshulam is one name or 2 names. Oh, I want to go with 6 and 6 because, in my opinion, it's reenacting Harival. Remember in Harival, the Levim, they read the Brachot and Klolot and the Sefer in front of the people. And half of the tribes, 6 tribes on one side and 6 tribes on the other side. So I think his reading of the Torah and teaching the Torah with 6 people on each side is going to maybe reenact what happened at Harival. Or it could be just, but I think the fact that 6 and 6 makes a lot more sense than 6 and 7. Now, what happened next? This is halacha we have to this day. Vayiftach Ezra sefer leinei kol ha'am, ki me'al kol ha'am haya. That proves that the bima was high up. He does what we call nowadays hagba. Ukipitcho amdu kol ha'am. That's hagba. Now, according to this, we do hagba before kriyat Torah, which according to these psukim, it's obviously the proper minhag. Edot Mizrach. Remember, if you've been to a Sephardi shul, that's what they do, and they simply do. They do a much better job of keeping minhagim. I actually have to look that up one day. Maybe you've had a share on that before. How Ashkenazim, why we do it Hagba afterwards? You ever hear about that, Jay?
Why? No. I mean, it's clear the Sephardic minhag, that's the old minhag. I don't know why.
That's the way to do it, yeah. And you do it before the first bracha. You open up, you do hakva.
You're right.
That's Birchat Torah. Benu kolam amen amen. B'mo yidehem, v'ktu v'shtu l'Hashem apayim arza. But we don't do that in shul. That's full prostration. They lift their hands high up and then bow down like we do maybe on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur in Aleinu and the Seder Avodah. But I guess that's a big event also. So Ezra makes this big bracha and everyone answers amen. And then the people who were with him, what did they do? Ba'levim mevinim et am the Torah. That was my, I said before. What's happening? The Levim who are, these are the teachers who are teaching the people the Torah, and the people standing up, learning it. So maybe that's the reason why we should stand up for Kriyat Torah as well. Vayikruv sefer Torah Elohim beforas, beforash, with some sechem, ve'evinu b'mikra. And Chazal learned from here that when you read the Torah, you have to translate it in language they can get. So the idea of Tirgun comes from here as well. So that's a half of day of learning. Now, they've been learning for half a day. They're working together now, got it? Nehemiah and Ezra, the political leader now, the madrich and the mechanech and the teacher, and the levim and the teachers, Adam, the cholam, bayom, what they, hayom kadosh l'Hashem elohim. You know what? Enough is enough. Too much learning today. Teis yom tov. Antidablum. People will say, oh my gosh, all these laws. Now, are they sad because they haven't been keeping these laws? And they wish, are they sad because now they have all these laws they have to keep? I'm sure it was half and half. But the people aren't happy. Either they're sad because, oh my gosh, there's all this religion they didn't know about. And they feel bad that they haven't been keeping it. Or are they sad because all these laws we have to start keeping now? Two sets of dishes, all these things, who knows what's going to happen? Okay? It says, don't be sad. Bal tivku, don't cry. Ki bochim kol ha'am kashama medivrei ha-Torah. People are crying when they heard the Torah. Now, is this crying why, oh, we have such a beautiful heritage? You know, how come we never heard this before? Are they crying because they feel guilty? They haven't been keeping the Torah? The main thing I want to prove from here, it's been 13 years since Ezra made Aliyah, and he came to teach Torah. And this is the first time they're hearing these things? There's no doubt that Ezra's success is only thanks to Nehemiah's political endeavors and his hadracha, because he got the people involved in the project. Now, and now we're going to see Nehemiah's effect on Ezra. There's going to be two big basic principles in education, in group education, we'll see here. Ve'emar lehem, luchu ichlu mashmanim ushtu mamtakim. It's Yom Tov, right? That Chazal learned from here, it's usher to fast on Rosh Hashanah. There's a sukkah. People used to fast on Rosh Hashanah. But all the poskim who hold that it's forbidden to fast on Rosh Hashanah, the source is right from here. So what did we do? Go send good food, sweet foods to one another. We'll return to this idea in a minute. Sending portions to people who don't have. Why? Remember Ladoneinu? Everyone knows that from Rosh Hashanah davening, don't we? But the nusach we have in our davening of Ki Kadosh Yom Ladoneinu, Davka and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, comes from here. Alti Eitzvu Ki Chetat Shem Himu Uschem. In other words, you shouldn't be sad because it's Yom Tov today and God's happy when you're happy. You shouldn't be sad on Yom Tov. You have to be happy. And that's going to be your strength. But it wasn't so easy. Quiet, everyone's all my what's gone. Quit mumbling and quit worrying so much. And therefore, so they listen when you tell people it's time to eat. Didn't take that much convincing. And they went to have a nice Yom Tov meal. Now, a word about Mashalach Manot, which we're going to get back to when we get to Rosh Hashanah. A lot of people say that Mashalach Manot on Purim is in order to make it a Yom Tov, because the ancient minhag was to send Mashalach Manot on Yom Tov. Now, how do we know there was an ancient minhag on Yom Tov to send Mashalach Manot? From Nehemiah. This is Rosh Hashanah. Not just on Shalosh Regalim, even on Rosh Hashanah, I guess not on Yom Kippur, but on Rosh Hashanah, there was a minhag to send manot to one another. And therefore, when Mordechai and Esther institute Mishloach Manot Ish L'Reihu, it's in order to make it a Yom Tov. I'm going to respectfully disagree with that approach, because there's a difference between Shichum manot le'ein nechodo, which I think is 100% true. That's every Yom Tov. In fact, that's exactly, it's also on Shabbat. I think the first mission in Shabbat that's teaching you the laws of carrying from one domain to another. What example does the Mishnah bring? Remember the first Mishnah in Shabbat? The poor man outside the door and the balabait, the homeowner, inside the door, and they're passing things to one another. What are they passing? I think it's an example of someone giving food to a poor person. The ani is outside collecting food for a Shabbos meal. So I think the minig of giving food, shochem le nechondo, it's not just Yom Tov, it's Shabbos. It's Jewish life, especially on Shabbos and Yom Tov. On Purim, Mishloach Manot Ish L'Re'ehu is a different concept. There's also Matot Levyonim, for sure. But why Mishloach Manot Ish L'Re'ehu? It's not sending food to people who are poor. It's giving food, even people who aren't poor, just friendship. Not tafka, not to a poor person. Someone you're friendly with, someone who doesn't need food but might need friendship. That phrase of Ish L'Re'ehu, we'll see how important that is when we compare Megillat Esther to the book of Zechariah. But we have our work cut out for the next, over the next, before Purim, we'll deal with that topic. I'm just mentioning it now, so we have a basis for our discussion later on. What's important for us now, he's telling the people, don't be so sad. Now come to the most difficult sections, okay? Uviyom HaShini, which he sends the people home to make Yom Tov meal, and he brings them back on the next day because there's more learning to do. Now, is this a proof that we're keeping 2 days Rosh Hashanah already back then? Also an interesting discussion. But when it says Uviyom HaShini, is it the second day of Rosh Hashanah and it's another day of Yom Tov? And we see there's already 2 days of Rosh Hashanah in the time of Nehemiah. Or is it the day, or it means the next day, and it's not Yom Tov anymore? You can argue, you know, take any side you want on that. It's not whether it was Yom Tov on that day, it's what law they learned on that day. Listen carefully. On the second day, they gathered to continue their learning. Nesfu Rashi Avot L'cholam, Makonim Alavim, El Ezra Sofer, Ulahaskil El Divrei Torah. It's day two of learning. Our first day of learning, we stopped in the middle. It was a little bit too heavy on them. It says, go eat, have a good time, enjoy Yom Tov, come back tomorrow, and we'll continue our study. In their study, we're going to focus on one law. What law do they find? Vayimtzu Ketub Torah, Asher Tziva Adonai B'yad Moshe, Asher Yeshvu B'nei Yisrael B'sukot B'chag, where do they find? Oh my gosh, there's a holiday. There's more than one holiday in the month of Tishrei. There's also Sukkot and a 7-day holiday. And they find in the Torah that we're commanded to sit in Sukkot in the seventh month. It sounds like they never heard of this before. Ezra's been around for 13 years, they never heard of Sukkot. Okay. No, and of all the laws, what happened to Yom Kippur? They don't mention Yom Kippur at all. They didn't know about Yom Kippur. They only know about Sukkot. And what happened all the other holidays? Why specifically Sukkot of all their learning? Keep the question in mind. Therefore, they sent the word out. Suahar, go out to the mountains. Everyone go out. Everyone has to build a sukkah. Now, there's a great discussion here. It sounds like we're using the wood from the trees to build a sukkah from what we use for the lulav and esrog. That's a great, again, there's lots of discussion in this, in modern scholarship as well. As far as, you know, what's the source of the Arba meaning? I don't want to deal with that topic now. I really don't think it's too big of a problem because that's the wood that's available. That doesn't mean that they didn't have Arba meaning, and if the Arba meaning were part of the sukkah, there was Arba meaning was one thing and sukkah was something else. But they're making the sukkah out of trees from the zayt and olive trees. That's right, olive leaves maybe for the schach, and good wood, and from hadasim and from tamarim, and branches from hadasim and things like that to make sukkot for the wood and for the covering. What's important for me though is not whether what halachot you have to make your sukkah out of. What's important for me here is why is this the specific law that they're teaching? Okay. And then what happened? Vayitzu ha'am vayaviu v'yasu lem sukkot ish al gagol v'chatzroteyem v'chatzrot beit Elohim v'rchov sharamayim v'rchov sharafraim. the people actually listen and they go out and they build Sukkot, everyone on their roofs and in their courtyards, outside the Beit HaMikdash, back by Watergate again, and by Shaar Ephraim. And one more line, and then we'll put all the questions together. This is the biggest question. Sukkot, the entire nation who had returned from their captivity. What captivity we're talking about? Since Korban Bayit Rishon, unclear. But they make Sukkot. Vayishvu basukkot. Now they built Sukkot. They sat in their Sukkot. Ki lo asu mimi Yoshua ben Nun came. Bnei Yisrael ad hayom hu. Batisim chag dola mod. It was the first Sukkot since the time of Yeshua. How could that be? We had so many great kings. David HaMelech didn't have a sukkah. How can we say Arocham and Yochim Sukkot David HaNofele? How could it be there was no sukkah in the time of David, in the time of the Shoftim, in the time of Shmuel and Navi, Eliyahu? Of course they had Sukkot. So what the answer is, this is the most monumental Sukkot since the time of Yeshua. Of course they have, but this is like the big one. I'll just give, that'll be in the answer. Let me summarize the questions. The question is, why is the specific focus on building Sukkot? And why, and how could it be that no one kept Sukkot till now? And how could it be that no one knew about it? And finally now, and I'll begin my answer with Pasuk Yudchet. What are they doing in their Sukkah? Now we built them. And this, unfortunately, we don't keep this minhag so much. Vayikra b'sefer Torah Elohim yom b'yom min ha'yom ha'rishon ad yom ha'acharon v'yasu chag shivat yamim uv'yom ha'shmini yatzar k'mishpat. What did they do in their sukkah? They didn't just eat in their sukkah. They studied Torah in their sukkah every day from the first day to the last day. It doesn't say about anything else they did in sukkah. Of course they ate in their sukkah. But what they did in their sukkah, they studied Torah and they made the holiday. Now I want to answer everything with what I call informal education. Ezra's goal was to teach the people Torah, but he's teaching to ears that are not open and not ready. The first thing you need to do, you need to get the people involved physically. You have to give them a project. And what enabled Nehemiah to succeed? His project of getting everyone involved in building the walls of the city. The same thing what happens in camp. Give the kids a building project. If you want to teach the kids Torah in the summer, the last thing you're going to do is sit them down like you do in school and put them in a classroom. And that's why schools fail all the time. Not fail all the time. But kids hate learning because it's not normal for kids to sit in a classroom all day long. Kids love building, discovering things, doing projects, building things. Once you have them building and working on projects and being creative and working as a group together and building a group dynamic, then they're teachable. You can start educating them when they're ready. And what happens the first time around is Nehemiah's project of building up the walls of the city, rebuilding national pride. We can do something. And giving people the faith in themselves that we can do something. Because all the time they're under this foreign rule and the local population is giving them a hard time. They feel like fourth-class citizens. Nehemiah builds national pride in the people. And not just by giving them speeches, by giving them projects. And that's what we saw last week. They built the wall. We didn't read it all, but because it was too complicated to read. But they built the wall. We had a whole chapter how each part of the wall was a different group of people. He made a civil defense force. He had a little army. And he had army plans, and he had a guy with the shofar, and these guys with their hammers, and these guys with their swords, and people on guard duty. He got people involved. And now the people involved, and they finished the project, now we can gather the people together, and we can do something with our project. Now we can teach Torah. I'll give you a really bad example you might remember from your childhood or when you see your grandchildren. One thing the kids always love to do is making a tent inside the house. Let me stop my screen share for a minute. See if anyone remembers this. Remember kids want to play a little bit in the house? So they take the couch, they move the pillows around, and they get a blanket. Mommy, it's a natural thing kids love doing. Once they build the tent and it's all up, now what do? Something. You can't do nothing. So they do, they get pretzels, they'll read a book in there, they'll bring the toys in there, they'll set up. But you have the project, you're building something. And after you build it, you have to use it. Do something inside. Okay. The same thing here. We built a walled city. We have to use it. And what are we going to do? We're going to gather together and we're going to use it and build and do something with it. Now we're going to learn. Just like on the national level, we built the walls of the city and used it to have our Torah gathering on Rosh Hashanah. Nehemiah is going to do the next step. Just like we built the walls of the city, everyone's going to now go out and build their own sukkah. And everyone's going to have their sukkah. Now that you built sukkah, what are we going to do in our sukkah? We're going to continue Torah study for another 7 days. We're not skipping. It's not they didn't know about Yom Kippur and we skipped Yom Kippur that year. That's not the topic. I simply want to understand Nehemiah working out with Ezra. What I'm trying to explain to is that Nehemiah, as a madrich, as a national leader, knows how to build national pride and giving national projects, get the people involved in doing things. And that's going to make the people, get them ready, mature for education. In Chumash, you have something very similar. It's called building the Mishkan. You know, coming out of Egypt, God does everything for us. We're too passive. Even the Luchot, God does the whole thing himself. And when the people aren't involved enough, they start going astray. To fix things, the building project of the Mishkan is something very similar. In order to return to God, Am Yisrael needs a project to do. And everyone has to be involved. You have to build something. And after you build something, then you can do something with it. It's one of the main things, and that's why kids, even though they learn a lot less in summer camp than they do in school, what they learn in camp they remember because they did it through an experience. Now, I want to add one other thing about the greatest sukkah since the time of Yoshua Benun. I'll give you an example, I think I'll explain anything else because you're all, I'm sure you remember this when you're from your youth, from our age group. There was a war called the Six-Day War. I'm sure you've heard of it. Some of you might remember it. Six-Day War was in the beginning of June, but it was in when? It was the beginning of, the end of Iyar. I think, wasn't it? Yeah, the end of Iyar, and right before Shavuot. A couple of days after the Six-Day War is over, the old city's been enhanced the first time. The first holiday after we liberated and reunified Yerushalayim and liberated the old city, and we had the Kotel was in our hands again, not just our bayit, but also the Kotel. What happened? Shavuos morning was the most amazing Shavuot in Am Yisrael's history. Anyone, it's well known, 26th of Iyar. It's like Chavchet B'Iyar is Yom Yerushalayim, that's right. So the 6th of Iyar began on the 26th. So a week later was Shavuot. That Shavuot, the streets of Jerusalem were just packed. And I think Shavuos morning was this massive aliyah, the regal to Yerushalayim, unprecedented in Jewish history. Now, people had kept Shavuot beforehand, but there had never been a Shavuot like that since, I think, maybe since the time of, maybe since probably Matan Torah or since Yeshua. That doesn't mean people to keep Shavuot beforehand, but that's the way the Bible sort of, let's say, exaggerates, but emphasizes how big an event is. I'll give you two other examples from earlier stories in Tanakh. When Chizkiyahu makes a great Passover, when they rededicate the temple after cleaning up all what Ahaz did wrong, if you remember that in Sefer Melachim, it's also in Divrei Hayamim, it says there was never a Pesach like that since the time of Shlomo Melech. And then about a half a century later, in the time of King Yoshiyahu, during the time of Yirmiyahu, King Yoshiyahu, he also does a massive reform, the Josean reform. He also does a massive Passover to bring the people back to God. And they were told there was never a Passover like that since the time of Shmuel, or since the time of the Shoftim. So make up your mind. What was the greatest Passover? And that's biblical style to say, it doesn't mean there was never one like that. I mean, they didn't keep it before. But it was the most amazing one, meaning this was a monumental event. And just like the first Sukkot, in the time of Yeshua, that's after the desert experience. Now we're coming back in our land. It's the first time in the sense that we've returned to at least a bit of sovereignty and a bit of unity in the beginning of Beit Sheni. And this gathering, if you call it the derivative, if you know what that is, the rate of change, right? The derivative between the year before Nehemiah came and the year after he came is almost like the change of from the year before Yeshua and the first year of Yeshua after he conquers the land. It was simply an amazing event that was simply great. So all the questions that people ask How come they never heard about Sukkot before? And how come they never heard about Yom Kippur? Where's Yom Kippur? And where's all the other laws? I think the main topic here is Torah education. Now, okay, someone mentions in the chat, like Sima Sash in Madison Square Garden. Right? That's like, there's probably never an event like that since probably Mamad Har Sinai with so many people at a Torah event. Now, so what I'm trying to explain is that when you understand the topic here is sort of rebuilding the nation and understanding Nehemiah's political leadership and how he's able to work together with Ezra. Simply, Ezra came with a goal, and it's clear from this story with Nehemiah that Ezra wasn't successful until Nehemiah came. And you need political, I'm just giving a pre-camp, I used to teach pre-camp, you know, in Moshava. So it was when you want to inspire Madrichim, what their job to do is, to, if you want to get students to listen and learn Torah, it's got to begin with projects and hands-on things and doing things and group work and group identity and putting them in the right frame of mind, and then they become teachable. And then, so did they keep Yom Kippur that year? I'm assuming they did. Why wouldn't they keep Yom Kippur? And had they heard of Sukkot? Of course they heard of Sukkot before, but they never kept the Sukkot like that. I'll bring one example for, again, you guys are my age group. In the 50s and 60s, 70s, when you went to shul on Sukkot, there's probably three lulav and esrogs for the whole shul, and one sukkah for the whole shul. No one built their own sukkah, maybe the rabbi and a couple, you know, right? And no one had their own lulav and esrog. The sukkah was, every shul had a sukkah, and you came to sukkah and you made kiddush, you made a bracha, and that was it. Everyone with their own sukkah, everyone knew about sukkahs, because there's yisker the last day. So of course they know about sukkahs. But no one had their own lulav and esrog, and no one had. Nowadays, everyone's got their own sukkah, and they got a bigger sukkah than a neighbor, and they got the best lulav and esrog, and they go to Israel for sukkah. You follow? There's a whole, it changed up. It's not that no one knew sukkahs before, but again, I think it's part of our return to our Jewish identity and return to Jewish sovereignty and things like that. The holiday became much, much, much more strengthened. So I think that's what's happening here in the book of Ezra. And now we need to take this. Oh, yeah. Okay. I'm getting a lot of agreements on this. They remember the same phenomenon. I don't think Borough Park was like that, but everywhere else in America was like that. Now, so back to, again, you're right. Some instances, there's also now more economic, now the economy's stronger. People are building. That's the way to get a country started. And we have very similar things happening. After the Six-Day War, not only to return to our land and having an army, Torah study increased like crazy ever since we won the Six-Day War, and there's much more Jewish pride. And have Jewish pride, even if you remember the story of Russian Jewry, it was the Six-Day War and the national pride of Russia, of the Six-Day War that led to resistant movements in Russia, people not afraid anymore to say they're Jewish. From what I remember, no one in America wore the kippot in public, no one wore a yarmulke in public until the Six-Day War. It was only after the Six-Day War that people, even rabbis didn't wear the rub. No one wore a yarmulke in public. Yarmulke was for sure. But the idea of walking around with a yarmulke on was, I think, only began after the Six-Day War. There's something about national pride and not being afraid of who you are that can lead, when it's utilized the right way, can lead to an educational movement. Now, I guess I'll stop here for the chat. Let me just go share my screen one more time and explain what we're not going to get up to today. I guess we have to go back to this after Purim, because there's so many more things in Nehemiah. But what happened? Now we have Bahab. After Yontav, and this is the source of Bahab. You know what Bahab is? It's a, no one keeps it, most people don't keep it, but there's 3 days of fasting after Yontav's over. After Yom Tovim are over, after Sukkot and after Pesach, there's a fast on Monday, Thursday, and Monday, for in case people did things wrong over Yom Tov. So now that it's over, now it's time to do real tshuva. Okay. And what do we see? What do we see from here? I mentioned this when we did Ezra. Again, we get rid of our foreign wives, and they start admitting their sins. What happened for the last 13 years since Ezra came? All this simply proves that Ezra's first aliyah, I mean, his main aliyah in year 7, was way less than he expected, both in Torah teaching and in national unity and getting rid of even of the foreign wives. There's still foreign wives in the time of 13 years later. And many people don't know Torah as ways Ezra's hoped they would. But the person who was able to get the ball rolling was Nehemiah, not thanks to his Torah teaching, but thanks to his hadracha, thanks to his national leadership and building national pride and making life exciting in Israel and taking on their enemy. Now, what do we do during, now that people bought into the system, now it's time to do real tshuva. The kuma al-lumdam, they grew b'sefer Torah Hashem Elohim, revit hayom, revit mitfadim, shakrim Hashem Elohim. Then they have a fast day, they learn Torah, and then they talk about the community, and they have a proper fast day. Then we get to the prayer, and just a quick preview. In this prayer, during this time, all the vim get up, and they bless God again. They get up and they call out to God and cry out. Etc. Where do they tell the people? Kumu, baruch at Hashem. Say baruch. Okay. What do we do in davening? We go from Vayvarech David, which is from the time of David in Divrei Hayamim, we go right to here for what he called. Vayvarechu Shem Kvodecha, Vatao Shem Elokeinu Levadecha. This we quote in davening. So this is a whole shiur on this topic. We have to deal with it later. Why we put this in davening. And we have to see this speech that he starts with is going to be a big introduction. It's a whole chapter of introduction, which is going to lead to a whole new gathering and the whole like almost reinstitution of Judaism, what we call all the gzerot from the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, or Anshei Kesef HaGdola starting sort of re-engineering Judaism from biblical Judaism to rabbinic Judaism, pretty much begins around here. We have a whole Jewish history. We have to talk about it and how it relates to Brit Ben Abtarim. Hopefully we'll try to relate this later to what happens to our study of before Pesach. And then at the end, they say at the end, now we're still, even though all this history, we'll do the story later on, we're still under foreign rule. Okay? And the land you gave our forefathers is still under Persian rule. Okay? And the produce that we're giving goes to other kings who have to pay taxes to other rulers. This would be the famous treaty that Ezra makes. And they're going to reaffirm mitzvot d'oraita, and they're going to take upon themselves what we call mitzvot d'rabbanan. We'll have a whole interesting discussion on this. That's going to require a whole other set of shiurim. I simply wanted to finish Nehemiah to understand this time period and how much of a failure it was how unsuccessful Ezra was and how Nehemiah enables them to become successful. And now we're ready to try to understand what happened between the temple being built in the sixth year of Dayavesh and Ezra's Aliyah in year 7 and then Nehemiah's in year 20 of Artaxasta, what happened in between? And the fact that there's so little that people know this time period will help us understand what's happening in between in that gap. And of course, we're going to explain that gap. It's the story of Megillat Esther. This will give us enough information to pinpoint when was Megillat Esther, and we understand when it's happening. In contrast to the rest of Jewish history, we'll be able to understand who's Achashverosh of the Megillah and what the Megillah is about, what's it's alluding to, what's its for, what's its open message and what's its hidden message. Okay, I'll look at the chat now real fast. Stop the share, and I think I missed a lot of chats. Oh my gosh, 17. Let's see what happened here. Divrei Yamim, I'll start from the beginning. Okay, why Divrei Yamim is different than, that's a class on Divrei Yamim. In other words, what's the agenda of Divrei Yamim? It's not Jewish history. It's got an agenda that has to do with the Mikdash. I'm not sure whether, of course, it's written during Bayit Sheni, but you're right, they don't make a big deal about David and Goliath and rebelling, but there could be more than one reason for that. But your point, I hear your point that we don't describe David HaMelech as a great soldier in Divrei Yamim, because in the beginning of Bayit Sheni, we don't want to make it look like we're militant and militaristic and people think we're rebelling. Why should so many Jews be on the side of Sambalat? That's a great question. Simply read Jewish history. I'll give a bad example, but before Nehemiah came, we saw when Ezra came, there's tons of mixed marriage. When you're under foreign rule and other people running the show, you know, it's called a shtadlin. You have to survive. If the people running the city, if the people have the ear of the Persians, is Sambalat, then if you want to survive, you have to basically, you need connections. I can't say anything political, but you could have people, the most corrupt people running your running thing, but for the sake of the Jewish community, you need connections with them. Without them, you have nothing. I'm not taking sides right or wrong, but many times in Jewish history, you're going to make political alliances and have connections with people who are not your, you're not your lamed vav tzaddikim, but for the sake of your survival, you got to. What did people do early with Germany? Remember, in other words, how much do you work with the German government? How much do you rebel against them? Let's leave things quiet. Let's pay this guy off. How many people we paid off to sneak people out here and there? That format of not evil people, but rather that's the way you survive. Now, on top of that, people want political power. So if they're in power, I'll work with them. Maybe I'll be in power over the Jews. But it doesn't, no, why so many Jews would be on the side of Sambalat, I wish would be a good question. It's a good question, but it's something that we suffer from a lot. Hadrachah is more like, I wouldn't say madrachah is like administration. Hadrachah is hadrachah. I can't translate it. Hadrachah is being a good madrich, like the coach of the basketball team. It's not the guy running it. It's not the guy who administration, like he pays the salaries. The guy, the coach of the team, who he says, yeah, we can beat him kind of stuff. Oh, a dais. Okay. It's what you call a platform on top. Okay. Tower sounds like the pulpit. Okay. But the pulpit in shul, in church, is in front of the congregation. This is in the middle of the congregation. So people could see. That's what they have in Sfat. Okay. This is something directly from, wait a second. Jay asked me a question. Jay, explain me your question. It's a long one. You wrote it to me.
My question, it's a little bit, I'm not sure you want to get into it. I don't really know that your pshat is correct. If I may, it's not what it sounds like. It sounds like the mamish didn't know what sukkos was. And there's lots of
evidence. I agree that that's a standard approach, which I'm coming to. I was trying to refute that. I'm not sure I'm right, but I understand.
It's a very sensitive subject, but the bottom line is it raises serious issues about. Yeah. Anyways, we can discuss it afterwards.
Okay.
But that's a question. I hear what you're saying. I'm not saying they're not approach. I'm saying the simple meaning. I'm not saying that's the only meaning. Is they
my approach is based on my experience in hadrachah.
Uh-huh.
That's just like madrich in yeshiva. I just have seen through my life how hadrachah works, when it works and when it doesn't work, and how inspired kids can be when you give them a project to do, and you can take the biggest bum kids who never opened up a book in their life, and they're all excited about Judaism once you give them something to do with their hands. And give them, and when you build national pride and things like that, and you see it in recent Zionist history as well, like Sima Shas. Okay, the same thing. Listen, the same question comes with Yoshiel finding the Sefer Torah.
Right.
In my opinion, I think I have an answer for that as well.
I'm sorry, I made those comments private, so maybe we should explain a little.
Okay, I'll say that also. Okay, fine. Okay. They remember the time. Okay, return Jewish identity or greater economic. It's both Jewish identity and economic opportunity usually go hand in hand, but Jewish identity makes people want to be involved with community instead of hiding and being embarrassed. You're Jewish, you're proud. You're Jewish. Once you're proud, you're Jewish, and you take action. That's how that sparks an economy. Okay, Minnesota people had their own sukkah and shul. Okay, like in most other places, didn't. Who could afford the lulav back then? That's true. That could be another reason. Okay, as I Soviet Jewry. Okay, a little bit beforehand, but State of Israel must have been the first step, okay? Was Sammy right? Could the reason they needed teachers was not much to explain the things, but rather teachers who couldn't hear? Oh, that's it, they didn't have microphones back then. There was no Tzumet microphones for Ezra, and it was on Yom Kippur, so it could be the Mevinim. I wish it was so crowded, but listen, If there's Mevinim, that means some people did know the Torah. It wasn't totally unknown. Because the Mevinim didn't hear from him and just explain it. They're not just translators. They're teachers. But the Nehemiah and Ezra, they're the big authorities. And they got things moving. And now the teachers have who to teach. Why did Shlomelech marry the Paro, the daughter's Pharaoh? Shlomelech, that's for international, that's to make, oh, I mean, as far as Nashim Nochriot, okay, I got the question. When Shlomelech marries Pharaoh's daughter, that's a political treaty, not because there weren't enough Jewish girls to marry. That wasn't regular Shiduchim. That wasn't Nashim Nochriot. Later it turns into trouble, but when the king marries, in ancient times, when you made a political treaty with another country, you married their daughter. And that's Shlomo's many wives means many political treaties, but that's a different lecture. Okay. Being national pride. Okay. I agree on the why people should do the army, but that's more political question. Okay. And what happened with Spain and Portugal? What happened in Spain? Like that, Jay, that's your, explain that one, Jay. What happened
to Spain? Suzanna can explain. I assume she's talking about the expulsion. I'm not sure exactly.
No, that's the marriage for political reasons.
Ferdinand and Isabella.
I thought, what happened? Okay. You're talking about, no, yeah, that's between the French and how about England and France? And, you know, all the royal family. Now, there's a lot of reasons. That's political treaty, also for political security. Because if you attack the other king, oh, you're attacking your daughter-in-law. You're attacking your son-in-law, your daughter. So it's also a safety measure to marry within the royal family. But also it's called hijos and things like that. Okay. Very good. And Americans have what's called a pathfinder. Okay, which is also a leader, not just also moral path. Very good. But that's the idea of leadership. So Nehemiah is such a great leader. Again, he's an awesome politician. But I think the beauty of Nehemiah is not just his political intrigue, which is for sure tremendous, and how he grows. Again, I agree that when he comes, he has this position of governor. Did he come officially as governor or just as a, to build things? He became governor. We can discuss that when we get back to Nehemiah. He definitely grows into the position. We had a discussion last week whether he was a big shot before he left, which was Dr. Zalkheim says, which I'm not arguing with, but I just brought the possibility. He might have just started as a butler and became a big shot. He definitely, but at the end of the day, he was a great political leader, no doubt, and a great diplomat. I was simply looking at, that's looking at Nehemiah from a international point of view, how he deals with foreign powers. I was looking at Nehemiah from the Jewish side of how he's able, how his political leadership is a catalyst that enables Ezra to start teaching Torah. That's the main point I want to get across today. And something that I've rarely seen, dealt with frontally. Everyone talks about Nehemiah and all things and all these questions about sukkahs. I'm trying to give a very realistic reason of why, from point of education, of why the building of the wall was so important. And only after the wall was built, they had this gathering to study Torah. And when they studied Torah, having everyone go out and build sukkot of their own was to continue this idea, to continue Torah study. And that we know it worked because the revival of Jewish education, what we call Rabbinic Judaism, begins here. That's for sure. The religion we have today is probably affected more by Ezra and Nehemiah's institutions than what Chazal say, if it wasn't for Ezra, if it wasn't for Moshe, Ezra would have given the Torah, and they're onto something big there.
Right.
Okay, so next week we'll get back to Purim. We have 2 weeks for Purim and Amalek, and we'll put the Megillah together. And the goal next week is to understand all the midrashim. Next week, I'll try to explain why Chazal said what they do, why they crunch the ears, and how they explain the Megillah historically, and how beautiful it fits. And then we have to bring why it doesn't fit, and how much better it is when you put the. I'll try to explain both sides and try to explain why it's so popular, why the popular opinion is so popular, and why the historical opinion is so meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
It'll take me a week or two.
Okay. Even if they disagree with each other. No.
I'll try to make it
as
little if possible.
No, Shteik Tuvim Achrizim. In other words, the Torah is full of that. I mean, whatever. I'm developing that theme, but
yeah, you can say two bechinot, two stories of creation to balance it, but
it's historically you can't say that. Elu ve'elu doesn't apply in history.
Yeah, either it happened before the temple was built or before.
Correct. So, although from a moral point of view, it doesn't matter. From an educational point of view, from a historical point of view, it matters a lot.
The deeper message from the Megillah makes a lot more sense. It's much more meaningful if you follow the historical.
Yeah. Anyways, that's you understand the two ways. But okay, we'll come back to
rabbinic approach is a cover up.
I'm sorry?
I said the rabbinic approach is a cover up. Unintended.
Yeah, that's then how do you deal with that question? I guess it's not everybody.
I'm going to suggest a good reason for it.
I'm sorry?
I'll try to suggest a very good reason why what the rabbis did.
You alluded to it in 586 BC. That's Rabbi Breuer's article, how Chazal purposely covered up things. So that works while people don't discover it. But in our area,
I'm going to go in a different direction.
But you understand what I'm saying? When we discover, quote unquote, the cover up, as you would call it, then we need to come up with another explanation.
Yeah. So the right word is going to be not a cover up, it's obfuscation.
Okay.
Where you hide something on purpose because you want people to find it. But the only people who should find it are people who are looking for it.
The Rambam. You're discussing the Rambam. That's the Rambam's approach.
It's the Rambam's introduction to Moreinu Bruchim,
right,
where he says, I have some deep ideas here, but it's not for the masses.
Right.
When you write in a way that the real deep message is only for people who know how to decipher the message, how to send a code so that only the people who need to read the code can read it, and other people don't, who shouldn't see the code, see it. That's the cool part. I have to show that in the beginning.
Right. I don't know that it applies here in the Chemia with the Sukkos or by Yoshiel finding a Sefer Torah. I don't think that applies, but yes, but.
Okay, maybe I'll give a separate share on that one day.
Yeah, that's an important share, but for another time that, Yoshiel found the Sefer Torah and it looked like it was all new to them. They didn't know what was going on. And how do we explain that in terms of everything? Okay, we'll have to wait for that share. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, have a good week, everybody. Stay healthy, and hopefully numbers will go down and life will get back a little bit to normal.